Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call's One Planet series. Today, we are marking Martin Luther King Jr. Day by talking about the history and the future of the environmental justice movement with Professor Robert Boulard, who is widely considered the father of the environmental justice movement. For the past four decades, Professor Boulard has studied and identified patterns of institutionalized environmental racism in the United States. He says climate change is the number one problem of the 21st century. We sometimes forget, though, that climate change is much more than simply parts per million. It is an equity issue. The most peculiar aspect of climate change is that the populations that contribute the least to the problem are most likely to feel its impacts. Such disproportionality makes it a serious social justice issue. So how can we use the environmental justice framework to find long-lasting solutions to the climate crisis? And what lessons can we learn from the civil rights movement? Robert Boulard is a distinguished professor of urban planning and environmental policy at Texas State University and former founding director of the Environmental Justice Resource Center at Clark Atlanta University. He is the author of 17 books that address very critical issues, and they're all connected, including sustainable development, environmental racism, housing, transportation, and climate justice. And Professor Boulard joins us from Texas. Hi, Professor Boulard. Thank you for joining us.
Yeah, glad to be with you. That's Texas Southern University, not Texas State.
Texas Southern University. Thank you. Thank you for that. Well, I'm so glad you can join us on MLK Day. And before we dive in and talk about the history of environmental justice and how it links with the civil rights movement and Dr. Martin Luther King's philosophy, I just want to get your take on where we are today. I mean, we've done show after show about the Trump administration's relentless successful efforts to roll back environmental regulation and weaken laws on pollution, clean water, pesticides. I mean, the list is just so long. What are your thoughts on where we are today and how this is all really affecting communities of color and poor communities?
Well, I think you have to look at these rollback, pushbacks, attempts to dismantle environmental regulations and environmental rights as a continuation, as well as correlating neatly with similar rollbacks in civil rights. You know, the whole idea of the right to breathe clean air as a basic right, also the right to vote. And so when you look at the overlay and the landscape, it's not two different things. Just as the environmental justice movement grew out of the struggle and fight for civil rights and human rights. So those of us who have worked on this these issues for many years, and with the technology and tools we have today, we can really map the attacks on the environment, environmental regulations and environmental laws, and map the attacks and attempts to turn the clock back on civil rights and human rights and voting, et cetera. It's the same map.
Mm. Yeah, and it's so, like, we'll talk about intersectionality, which I listened to a number of your speeches over the weekend, and you bring that up a lot because all of these issues are connected. And I just want to stay on one topic briefly because this deserves so much attention. The New York Times had a great piece recently called Science Under Attack, How Trump is Sidelining Researchers and Their Work. And the list is so overwhelming and exhausting, but they're even getting rid of funding health centers nationwide. There were 13 children's health centers nationwide that studied, among other things, the effects of pollution on children's development. And we know that this directly affects children of color and poor communities. This year, the EPA ended its funding, just got rid of it. So now all of that work has stopped.
Well, you know, the fact that these attacks on science and facts and the attacks on those individuals that are in the business of producing knowledge and documenting with their research and their findings, their studies. These things now are somehow seen as expendable. And what it will do is place us, the nation, at risk in terms of falling further and further behind when it comes to competing globally. The fact that these centers, whether it's child asthma centers or environmental health centers that were set up, health disparity centers, et cetera, that were set up for the reason that there were real problems. These are not made up problems, they're real. And so the idea of that we can somehow turn the clock back 20, 25 years and somehow ignore the fact that these are real issues and real concerns, and just by wiping these centers out, you don't necessarily wipe the problem out. The same thing was true in terms of somehow when the, for example, the Center for Disease Control at one point was considered gun violence as a health issue, and then you know, this whole idea, well, let's not the gun lobbies, let's not study gun violence as a health issue, and if you don't do the study and come up with the results and some of the solutions, then there's no problem. That is just a head in the sand kind of position.
Professor Boulard, you have been doing scholarship and advocacy work for decades on environmental justice, and we'll talk about how you got involved in this work. But before we do that, the term environmental justice is now being used on a pretty regular basis. What do you think about that? What does it really mean to you?
Well, you know, it's a double-edged sword. For decades, we were fighting and really pushing to get environmental justice recognized as a legitimate area and sphere of study and for research and for policy. And there's still a lot of work still needs to be done on that. And we were fighting to get this whole field of study institutionalized in our universities and colleges and other places and in government. And so we made a lot of headway on that. But I do think that in some areas, there are some people that have come to this whole idea that they can use environmental justice and somehow as a greenwashing or somehow not really giving the full thrust of concerns and the issues that are out there. And so it's, you know, environmental justice has gone mainstream as a concept, but I do think that by doing so, it has somehow gone into areas and arenas that is almost like, well, we talk about environmental justice, but it's more talk than action. It's one thing to, you know, talk the talk and another to walk the walk. We need more, I guess, emphasis on walking the walk and challenging and dismantling those structural barriers that create the inequalities, the disparities, whether it's racial or class or geography.
There have been a number of studies and a lot of criticism about the big environmental groups over the years and lack of diversity. When you say walking the walk, what major changes would you like to see, especially when you're talking about some of these big environmental groups and the work they do?
Well, for decades, we have identified the fact that the green groups or the big environmental groups do not represent in a way that's reflective of the diversity of this country. Back in 1991, environmental justice leaders wrote letters to the Big Ten, the green groups, and challenged their authenticity and representation in terms of people of color on their boards, their staff, and their agendas. And we also challenged the fact that these organizations were actually reaping the greatest benefits from foundation fundings and other funding. And very small amounts were going to frontline community organizations as well as communities of color. You know, and fast forward, you know, to 2020, very little has changed. Some changes have been made. You know, some of the organizations have people of color on their boards, and they have people of color staff, and in some cases, women executive directors, and have made small steps, baby steps. But the diversity issue is still a legitimate issue. Diversity in terms of what kinds of issues groups are dealing with, as well as what their staffs and boards are. But I think even a greater, gap for many of us is the lack of diversity of the green dollars, where the money flows. And it's one thing to talk about diversifying the organization, but if the money still goes to the same organizations and none of the and very little of the funding for the work that's on the ground in frontline communities and communities of color and working class communities, then I think that's still a big hurdle, a big gap, a big barrier. And we want to see diversifying the money so that our people of color organizations can, emerging organizations can do the work 24/7 in the communities where many of the issues are. That's still a big problem. And we ask, well, what's the fear of funding, you know, our organizations of color in the same manner that's deserved, and somehow not see it as if our organizations get funded, that means that other organizations are losing dollars. We shouldn't see it that way, as a zero sum game. We see this as a major priority, and particularly as the change in demographics of this country point to more and more people of color. And a majority of people call it 2042. My position is that we shouldn't be waiting until 2042 to get it right. We should be, you know, working on it right now, and so that this transition to majority organizations of color doing this work and challenging these very real problems and challenges that we face.
But Professor Bullard, since you talked about money and this is so important, for those of us who maybe don't know how the money is distributed, I mean, a lot of people are members of certain environmental groups. I know, you know, right before the end of the year, my email box was flooded with asks for money for a number of different groups. Can you just talk about how the big grants are dispersed and what has changed over the years when it comes to ensuring that these frontline groups do get funding?
Well, there are a lot of ways that fund organizations are funded. A lot of them is through donors, private donors that have relationships with the organization. But there are other ways that they're funded, through private foundations as well as through government grants. And what we've said all along is that, and not only the environmental justice organizations and climate justice organizations and people of color organizations, even some of the foundation associations have acknowledged the fact that some of the greatest work and the most impactful work that's being done is being done by small organizations that are based in communities. And if we're to get the biggest bang for the buck, then it means that those organizations that are closest to the community and closest to the issues need to be funded at a level that's commensurate with what they are producing and the output and the productivity and the change impact that they're making. And some of the private foundations have begun to move the kinds of resources and directing them toward those organizations that are based in communities and are led and by people of color. But we still have a large gap. And Professor Dorcita Taylor at the University of Michigan has done some groundbreaking work on this issue. And I think her latest report is that even, I think, 2019, less than 20% of the funds that from foundation, private foundations, are going to organizations that are dealing with environmental justice and climate justice. And even when you disaggregate that number, you're talking about even less, you know, 15% maybe going to people of color-led organizations. And people of color right now make up, you know, 38-39% of the U.S. population. And when you talk about those communities that are most impacted by environmental challenges, and you look at across the country, you know, you start looking at a disproportionate number of people of color and communities of color and low-income communities that are on the front line to these many environmental challenges. And climate is impacts no exception. And so it means that our organizations and our communities and our institutions are underfunded in so many ways that somehow places that would place us at a disadvantage in working on these issues. And when we developed the plan, the first National People of Color Environmental Leadership Summit in 1991 in Washington, D.C., we basically challenged foundations and organizations to start to redirect funds to those areas of greatest risk and greatest threat. And we said that then, and we say now, that we don't want our, you know, communities of color and frontline communities don't want, you know, the big groups parachuting into these communities and leading us. We have our own leaders. We have our own organizations and institutions. When it comes time to form coalitions and alliances and partnerships, we will stand together with our green group organization partners. But the fact is that our organizations need resources and need funds to develop our leaders and emerging leaders and our young people, our students, and our institutions. That's why it's important that it is not just environmental. It's also about in terms of educating and training and moving our young people to become leaders for the future. That's a that's something that we do not take lightly, and we will continue to advocate for this.
Professor Bullard, what's the relationship like between the large, mostly white environmental groups with the frontline environmental justice groups? You were recently, you spoke at the Commonwealth Club recently in San Francisco, and in that talk, you said that when we saw the major, major floods in Houston, that's what it took to get the mostly white environmental groups to come together with environmental justice groups. You said that these groups never talked, but because you had middle, upper income people affected, they now understand what environmental justice groups have been saying.
Well, you know, that's true. And what I also said is that we hope we wouldn't have to have a biblical flood to get environmental groups, green groups, groups that work on wetlands and marshlands and birds and all those kinds of environmental conservation issues to come together with organizations that are dealing with land use issues, dealing with food security, parks, green space, food deserts, and toxics, emissions from neighboring refineries and chemical plants. But that's what it took. And the idea that we shouldn't have to wait for very affluent communities to be impacted by environmental problems for them to understand that that the environmental justice frame says that no community should have to somehow suffer from disproportionate emissions from cars, buses, freeways, highways, or chemical plants or other kinds of built environment. Locally unwanted land uses. And so it's almost like of communities that have in Houston that's on the west side that enjoy very healthy, livable, green, sustainable, livable kinds of environment. And you travel across the east side is where all the polluting industries and refineries and petrochemical plants and all kinds of environmental threats. It's one city, but when you disaggregate and lay out and map the population, it's actually two. And what happened is in 2017, in August, Harvey was kind of like an equalizer. You know, nobody counted on, even with the best science, 53 inches of rain in a few days. And what it did, it put everybody at risk. And what we said in environmental justice, when we do not protect the most vulnerable, then we place everybody at risk. And the West Side flooded, a million, $2 million homes flooded. These are areas that never flooded. You know, the East Side, floods routinely, it flash flooded when it rains. And as a matter of fact, the same communities that flooded during Harvey on the East Side, we've had two 500-year floods before Harvey. And then we had Harvey. And then this last year we had Imelda. We had a tropical storm that didn't have a name, and it dumped as much water almost in some neighborhoods as Harvey. So the awareness level of some communities is such that it takes a disaster to get the attention. And I think we have to do a better job at communicating the risk and communicating the kinds of issues and challenges that we face.
Are those groups in Houston still working together today? Did they make connections?
Oh, yeah. What we did is that after Harvey, we pulled together three dozen organizations that work on a range of issues. And this is the first time we were able to get, groups with environment in their name or sustainability in their name or zero waste in their name or West Side community that work on this, that, and the other, to work with community organizations that have initials in their name, such as the NAACP or Texas Southern University, TSU, or organizations that work on chemicals on the East Side, or Tejas, which is mostly Latino groups, or neighborhood associations or civic clubs, fraternal organizations that work in a lot of communities of color, the black and brown community. We formed this Coalition for Environment, Equity, and Resilience, SEER. And the first thing that we did is to understand that we needed to get to know each other. You know, Houston is 600 square miles with over 500 neighborhoods. It's a big city, but it's a city that doesn't have zoning. And so not having zoning really places the communities, low-wealth communities and communities of color, at greatest risk. And so we explained that to some communities that had never met with some of the communities on the East Side. And so we said that we wanted to, we had some get to know each other, and then we came up with a plan, a strategy, to talk about how will we approach post-Harvey, and to understand that rebuild Houston does not mean rebuild it as it was, because as it was pre-Harvey, pre-2017 was very unequal, and that unequal in terms of who has what, and unequal when it comes to resources, how they get allocated in terms of flood mitigation, flood protection, in terms of environmental pollution, et cetera. And so we said that this is what we're going to do. And a big thing happened in 2018 called the midterm election. And it was a true blue wave that happened in Houston and Harris County. Most of the Republicans that were in office and that held office for many years that basically behind the scenes, even though they were in the numerical minority, they had the political power to persuade and to exert their will. They were swept out of office. And the new majority, Democrats, came in and were able to force their will when it comes to policy. First thing that we did, we said that we have to put in place an equity framework for how money's coming down for post-Harvey recovery is to be spent. And we said we can't just use the dominant paradigm that's been used for the last 50 years, money following money, money following power, and money following whites. If we follow that paradigm, then it means that the city will get rebuilt as it was, with most of the money going to that to the West Side. We got the Harris County Commission to adopt this framework. That's the framework that's in place right now, looking at all of the policies that are coming down when it relates to recovery and rebuilding and dealing with affordable housing. You start naming all the things, flood protection. This has never been done. This was never even talked about being coalitions coming together to exert this power and this will, the will of the majority. You know, Houston is 75% people of color, but you wouldn't know that from that 25% West Side that historically has wielded the disproportionate power. It's almost like a form of Texas apartheid, with that small minority running things behind the scenes and exerting their will and grabbing the power. We're not perfect yet. We still have a lot of work to do, but we're on our way for the majority realizing that they have the political power and they have the will to shape a new Houston, a new Harris County, and a new region.
Wow. Today we're joined by Robert Bullar, Distinguished Professor of Urban Planning and Environmental Policy at Texas Southern University. Professor Bullar is the author of 18 books that address a number of issues. You can find more information about him and his work. He is widely known as the father of environmental justice. I'm actually on his book page right now, and just here are a couple of titles: Race, Place, and Environmental Justice After Hurricane Katrina, Environmental Health and Racial Equity in the United States. Today, we're marking Martin Luther King Day with Professor Bullard by talking about the history and the future of the environmental justice movement. This is Your Calls One Planet series, and we'll be back after this. This is Your Calls One Planet series. I'm Rose Aguilar. Today we are marking Martin Luther King Jr. Day by discussing the history and the future of the environmental justice movement with Professor Robert Bullard, who is widely considered the father of the environmental justice movement. Robert Bullard is a distinguished professor of urban planning and environmental policy at Texas Southern University. He's the author of 18 books that address a number of issues, all connected, including environmental racism, housing, climate justice, and sustainable development. And if you'd like to join us, if you'd like to talk about the really just how things have changed within the environmental justice movement, if you're involved in it, we'd love to hear from you. And if you would like to give a shout out to any of the incredible frontline groups doing really important work, or if you work for one, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org, or you can tweet us at Your Call Radio. Professor Bullard, let's talk about how you got involved in this work. You were a sociologist at Texas Southern University in the late 70s, and that's when you began doing some research on environmental racism in Houston. And this is because your wife, attorney Linda McKeever Bullard, took a case representing members of a Black community who were fighting a landfill in their suburban neighborhood. Can you tell us more about that?
Yeah, I often tell the story that I was drafted in this work. And as a matter of fact, I graduated from Iowa State University in 1976, and we moved to Houston. And 2 years out of graduate school, 1978, my wife came home one day and said, Bob, I just sued the state of Texas and the city of Houston and Harris County. And I said, you did what? You sued the state of Texas? I said, you sued my employer. She said, yeah. She said, this company is trying to put this landfill in the middle of this predominantly Black suburban community, and I need somebody to collect data for this lawsuit. We're trying to stop this permit. And she said, I need somebody to find out where all the landfills are located and put it on a map, because I have to go into court in 2 weeks to try to get this temporary restraining order. I said, you need a sociologist. She said, that's what you are, right? I said, yeah. Well, before that, she had no idea what I did. You know, I left home every Tuesday, Thursday, or Monday, Wednesday, Friday, and went to work and came back at 5. But I said, well, I guess if you got to go in 2 weeks, then I'll have to see what I can do. I had 10 students in my research methods class, and I designed the study, and we did the analysis. There was no laptop, iPad, Google, no GIS. We did the studies. There was no database. It was sociologists as detectives, and using archival data, old records, driving out, windshield surveys, finding out give the students this list of landfills, incinerators, garbage dump sites, and have them to verify that this is actually a site, and then we'd come back and put it on a map. I tell my students, Houston is flat, large part is below sea level. If you see a mountain in Houston, landfill. And so we were able to do the study, and I finished this study in 79, and we went to court, and what we found in this study was that, this is 1979, this is so long ago, is that 5 out of 5 of the city-owned landfills were in black neighborhoods. 6 out of 8 of the city-owned incinerators were in black neighborhoods, and 3 out of 4 of the privately-owned landfills were in black neighborhoods. And this is from the 30s up to 1978. 82% of all the garbage, the solid waste dumped in Houston, was located in predominantly black neighborhoods. And that's like me saying, my family is predominantly black. These are all black neighborhoods. Houston is very segregated. 90% of black folks in Houston during that period lived in black neighborhoods, had one of the highest segregation indexes in the country. So this was an eye-opener for me. In that a city that doesn't have zoning somehow unofficially zoned its black neighborhoods for garbage. That's like saying black neighborhoods, you're garbage, and therefore garbage is compatible with garbage. This is environmental racism, this is environmental discrimination, and the Dean versus Southwestern Waste Management Corporation lawsuit was the first lawsuit in the United States to use civil rights law to challenge environmental discrimination.
So again, blacks made up 25% of the population from the 30s to 1978, but 82% of all the waste was dumped in black neighborhoods in Houston.
That's correct. That's correct. And I told people, I've traveled all across this country, been to every state and many cities across the country, and I've never found an oversupply in those percentages of the good stuff in black and brown neighborhoods. But this was a pattern, as I said, this is a pattern that we documented in 79. And you fast forward with studies coming out every year showing it's not just landfills and incinerators and garbage dumps, et cetera. It's also other kinds of locally unwanted land uses or LULUs.
So after Houston, you decided to expand the study to Dallas. And what did you find in Dallas?
Well, after the Houston case study, I said, well, I want to know, is this unique to Houston, or is this something just happening in the South? And so I got a grant from National Science Foundation, and I expanded to look at lead smelters in Dallas. And what we found in Dallas is all the lead smelters in Dallas were located in African-American and Latino communities. Expanded to Louisiana's Cancer Alley in terms of the chemical plants and refineries and incinerators, hazardous waste incinerators along Mississippi River Corridor. And same thing, same pattern. And I went to Alabama and found the largest hazardous waste facility in the nation, a facility that receives waste from all 48 contiguous states and at least, a dozen countries. The waste management facility in Emel, Alabama. Emel is 95% black, and Sumter County is 75% black. It's located in the Alabama Black Belt. And I went all the way to West Virginia and found a chemical plant located in the middle of this little black town called Institute. And this is the only place in the United States where the same chemical that killed all those people in Bhopal, India, the only place that chemical was manufactured is in Institute, West Virginia. Of course, Institute has always been black. But even in the 1860s, when black folks went with West Virginia, when West Virginia broke away from Virginia because West Virginia didn't want to be a slave state, and a lot of black folks went with West Virginia, and that Union Carbide sat down in the middle of that black community after World War II. And so I start using those case studies. That's how the book Dumping in Dixie came about in 1990. And Dumping in Dixie this 2020, we're talking 30 years, that book 30 years ago, and documented that in the southern United States, African-American communities are on the receiving end of all kinds of toxic dumping and pollution and environmental racism, and a lot of it correlates and matches up with the fact that these communities were basically disenfranchised when a lot of the problems and fighting occurred. Black people couldn't vote. They couldn't decide. They couldn't vote it down, these facilities down. And these are the same communities where lots of issues around justice and civil rights and voting and challenges to the political process. And so the Dumping in Dixie, Race, Class, and Environmental Equality was the first environmental justice book. And I wrote the book. It was only 160 pages, the first edition. I wrote it to get in the hands of communities that were fighting and struggling, and it includes some of the strategies that communities were using, and in some cases winning. And I wrote it, as I said, I wrote it to get in the hands of community folks, but Westview Press, which is in Boulder, Colorado, made it a textbook and charged $25 for the book. And I'm like, whoa, my people can't afford $25. They made it a textbook, and it got adopted, you know, at a lot of universities across the country. And so it became, a standard kind of a book in universities and colleges. But that's not why I did it. I wrote it because it was clear that this was an issue that needed to be addressed in the South. But later on, as I started expanding the analysis and framing to look at the entire United States, it was clear that this was not just a Southern phenomenon. Mm-hmm. And then start expanding even to the global frame that it was happening across the globe.
Professor Ballard, what happened when you started shopping this book around to publishers?
Oh, that's another story. You know, the whole idea is I had the manuscript completed in 1987. No, 1988, because I finished Invisible Houston in 1987. I had it ready in 88, and I shopped it for a year. Before I got some positive feedback, I got lots of letters, rejection letters, saying, from some really top publishing houses saying, there's no such thing as environmental racism. You can't use race and environment in the same sentence. That the environment is neutral. Everybody's affected the same. All kinds of, just anecdotal kinds of things that was just the opposite of what I was showing, what I found showing up in the data. And I finally, Westview Press in Boulder sent me a letter saying they would love to publish the book and market it and et cetera. And so that's how I was able to get it, the book published. I was never discouraged because I figured at some point in time it would get published because, the fact that when I would travel to these various communities and interview people and talk to people, they were telling me all these stories, and I was writing down these stories. It's almost like, this is real. This is not imagined. I go from one place to the next, and same kind of horror story. It's the same kind of tragedy in terms of people being not only disrespected in terms of their health and their communities, but in some cases just despoiling the whole community. Having a school located on top of a dump or next door to a refinery or chemical plant, and elementary kids. It's almost like a park. It's like, how can this occur in this very wealthy country with these laws? And so I said, well, I'm gonna keep trying, and again, perseverance is something that paid off.
Again, that book is called Dumping in Dixie, Race, Class, and Environmental Quality. The other thing I'm wondering is, given what you found in Houston, Dallas, Louisiana, are these same practices still happening today?
Unfortunately, yes. Ugh. And the problem has gotten worse in the last couple of years.
Yeah.
In that many of the regulations that we fought for and that we basically marched and demonstrated for and fought legal battles for are being rolled back or weakened or diminished. We fought for buffer zones and monitoring at the fence, and fought to have impact statements and all kinds of people of color and fence line communities and impact communities that serve on different task forces and boards, committees, have scientists that are doing the work, be represented on committees at EPA and other agencies. All of this is being basically rolled back. And so the idea that everything is, that these laws are permanent, even though the laws are still on the books, it's a matter of how much are they enforced. And when these pushback occurs at these pushback occur at the federal level, a lot of the states take their cue from the feds and do less. We saw this in civil rights. We also see it in environmental protection. And many communities on the ground don't trust their state agencies to do the right thing. Yeah, and again, a lot of the states, basically state environmental protection agencies, like in Texas is TCEQ, in Louisiana is DEQ, and you start in Alabama is ADEM. You start looking at these environmental state environmental agencies that are supposed to protect the public. They don't. They basically rubber stamp the industry, and in some cases, you can't tell the difference between the industry and the government, because in many cases, the industry provides the personnel for the agency, and they go back and forth at this revolving door. So things have gotten worse over the years, and the outcome will mean that when pollution is allowed to just inundate communities, we see health impacts. We see all kinds of negative impacts when it comes to the quality of life of populations that are most at risk. We're talking children, elderly. We're talking the impacts that are real and not something that's imagined or made up.
You brought up Cancer Alley when you expanded your research to Louisiana to look at what was happening along the Mississippi River corridor. It's commonly referred to as Cancer Alley, as you said. And earlier this month, the Louisiana Department of Environmental Quality granted a series of air permits allowing Taiwanese-based Formosa Plastics to build a massive petrochemical complex in St. James Parish. And this comes even though there's so much new and alarming information about levels of cancer-causing chemicals that this brand new facility would emit. It's going to allow Formosa to emit more than 13 million tons of carbon pollution every year, as well as huge amounts of cancer-causing chemicals. And the risk of cancer is the highest in the country there, 50 times the national average. And I know that you tweet a lot, Professor Bullard, so you probably saw this piece. The Guardian had a piece back in May, and it's called Cancer Town. Almost every household has someone that has died from cancer in this area.
Oh, yeah, I'm very familiar with the Guardian piece as well as what's going on in Louisiana. I've worked in Louisiana for 30 years, and the whole idea that this petrochemical corridor, this 85-mile stretch along the Mississippi River from Baton Rouge to New Orleans, it provides a huge percentage of petrochemicals and oil and gas. And so when we talk about 25%, 28%, 30%, you talk about this stretch along the river, and you see those communities, in many cases little towns that were founded right after slavery and in the 1860s, and some communities have bought land from their former plantation master and called it and carved out a place they called home. And the petrochemical industry came in after World War II and sat down right on top of community. It's ironic that back in the early 90s, we defeated Formosa. They were trying to get, this company was trying to get in to a community called Wallace, and we defeated them. And more recently, the idea that we defeated another company, Shentech, a Japanese company that was trying to get into St. James Parish. So it comes, you know, these companies keep coming because the invitations are there. The fact that this community, many communities along the river, and if you are inundated, plant after plant after plant after plant, if you look from the air and look down, it's unbelievable what has happened to those communities along the river. And if you, you know, and when you map it out, the communities, populations that live closest to these plants are people of color, mostly African Americans, and the workers don't reflect the proximity of the population or the community. In many cases, people drive in, you know, and drive out. They drive in some cases drive as far away as Mississippi and drive to those plants. And work 8 hours or some overtime, and they go back home. And the communities that are on the fence lines oftentimes don't even get the jobs. They could walk to work if the jobs were for them, but the jobs are not for them. And so they get sick. They don't get the jobs, they get sick, and their property values are lowered. In many cases, their quality of life is lowered. And again, this is something that has been a fight for, you know, since the 90s, in terms of people identifying this as a major environmental justice or injustice hotspot. You know, Louisiana's Cancer Alley and was at the top of the list of some of the organizing in the 80s and 90s. And as I said, we achieved a lot of victories, but again, it's these companies have lots of money, and they're able to maneuver and get, you know, government to side with them in terms of these permitting, these permits, and they somehow are allowed to get these permits even when there may be a community that has 12, 15 plants already, and the lack of protection or common sense environmental regulations allow these companies to create these environmental sacrifice zones, because there's nothing that would stop a company from getting a permit that's where the environmental justice community will say this area is already oversaturated. You know, there's nothing to say that should be cumulative a cumulative analysis done to look at the impact of all of these emissions that come from, you know, a dozen plants and that exist, and there's this proposal to put the 13th plant there. Mm. Well, there's nothing to say that this community is oversaturated. The company applied for the permit, and based on its own projected emissions, not what's already there. That's how we get, you know, communities with this pollution overload, or these environmental sacrifice zones, or these cancer alleys, or more recently they call them death alleys. It's more than a term. It's more than just a bumper sticker. This stuff is real.
Right. Professor Bullard, we're almost out of time. In this Guardian piece, a number of people who live in this area, for example, Lydia Gerard, her husband died from cancer in 2018. She said, "We can't give up. We won't give up. We have to continue to let these plants know that we're looking at them. It may not be in my lifetime that anything gets done, but I'm praying that it is." We have just a couple minutes left. Given the decades that you've spent on this, what is most effective when it comes to just taking on these corporations that are so closely connected to politicians?
Well, you know, there's no magic bullet. There's no silver bullet. Perseverance, organizing, educating, mobilizing, forming coalitions. The fact that many of these struggles have existed for many, many years. And again, it's about civil rights, human rights. It's about health. It's about, you know, it's about having maintaining residential integrity, maintaining a level of sovereignty that says that no company, no matter how much money they make or how many jobs they are promising, and oftentimes these communities get promises more than jobs, that can somehow erase the fact that there's damage being done. You have to understand that many of these communities that line the Mississippi River were formed right after slavery. They survived slavery and Jim Crow segregation, but may not survive this toxic racism that's being perpetrated today. And so we stand with these communities, and again, this is not a sprint. It's a race, but it's not a sprint. It's almost like a marathon, that these communities are not going to roll over and die. They have, you know, it's an intergenerational struggle, because this is land that communities, that residents have passed down from generation to generation. And again, the destruction of one's homeland, it's not something pretty. In some cases, some communities have been relocated, but not as a community. People be relocated one house at a time. They lose their community. They lose their solidarity. They lose their sense of belonging. This is a destructive process. Racism, environmental racism, is not a sexy topic. It's real. It's harmful, and it kills. It kills people, and it kills communities.
Well, Professor Bullard, thank you so much for all of your work, and we'd love to have you back. Happy MLK Day.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you so much. Robert Bullard is a distinguished professor of urban planning and environmental policy at Texas Southern University. He's the author of 18 books that address all of the critical issues that we talked about today. You can find more about his incredible work at yourcallradio.org. Thanks to Malihe Razazan for producing today's show, and Jonathan Linden, our intern. Thanks to Kevin Vance, our studio engineer. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call's One Planet series.